Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Nikki Ouellette. Campbell County is part of a national program aimed at strengthening and growing opportunities for local economies shaped by the coal industry.
It's going to be different if we have less coal, and it could be markedly different if at some point in the next 20 or so years, there's no coal.
The Eastern Shoshone Tribe debuted a new arbor at their annual powwow in Fort Washakie.
I like the new lights and the new seating. There's more room definitely for more visitors.
And an interview with Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg. That's all coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio.
Did you know that all six episodes of Human Nature's latest season are out right now? That's right. Season 9 of our award-winning podcast has a little bit of everything. A Wyoming man who spent his summer working as a night shepherd in Switzerland.
All I could hear was my breathing and the steps, and everything was so dark. And I just thought, okay, this must be what it's like to be an astronaut on the moon.
The story of one of the biggest animal rescues in history.
And I picked up the phone and they said, when can you get here? And so the next day, I actually took a plane because it never occurred to me what was ahead for me over the next few weeks.
And a woman who followed the gray whale migration hundreds of miles with her son.
I was exhausted one evening, fed up of trying to work. I'd had a really bad day. And so I was like, right, I'm not working. I'm going to read about whales.
Find Human Nature on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. That's Human Nature, one word, one N.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Nikki Ouellette. U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg visited Wyoming last week. He came to work with state officials on the collapse of Teton Pass, which Governor Mark Gordon had declared a state of emergency. Buttigieg also visited Cheyenne, where he saw progress on Highway 30, which has undergone various improvements to increase safety and efficiency. He carved out some time to talk with Wyoming Public Radio's Statehouse reporter, David Dudley, about the Wyoming Department of Transportation's progress on Teton Pass, roadway infrastructure, and electric vehicles.
WIDOT says that the rebuild will be done sometime around November. How confident are you in that deadline?
Well, certainly we defer to WIDOT in terms of the timelines and the project plans. Our role is to make sure that we dismantle any barriers that might be standing in their way, bureaucratic barriers, funding barriers, anything like that. And we want to be there to provide technical assistance, too.
What happens if it's not up and running by winter?
Well, we see the economic impact of this every day from the perspective of the tourism economy, and most importantly, from the perspective of people who now have to go an hour and a half out of their way, sometimes just to get to work or to where they need to be. So it really is something that's creating a major challenge for many people each passing day. And that's why there's a sense of urgency about getting it fixed.
Would you consider this to be climate related?
I don't know everything that went into the weather conditions that caused this incident, but what I will say is that we are certainly seeing more and more of this sort of thing in the face of climate change. And that's true more broadly across our transportation systems, whether it's slides like the one that took out a critical stretch of I-70 in Colorado a couple of years ago following a wildfire that contributed to the loosening of the soil, or a heat wave that made it necessary to shut down public transit in the Pacific Northwest because cables were in danger of melting. Every part of the country is experiencing these climate impacts, and they're hitting our transportation systems hard.
What can your department do to help with that?
Well, there's really two things that we're doing to contend with these climate challenges. One is to try to make our transportation systems cleaner and greener. We know that there are many things we can do to reduce the pollution that comes from transportation, whether it's making sure that there are more good, affordable options for electric vehicles, or making sure that there's good public transit. But also, no matter how good we get at that work, the reality is many of these climate impacts are already here, and so we're also funding resilience projects at a scale that's never been done before federally. The Biden infrastructure package includes about $7 billion for a program called PROTECT, which is specifically for making resilience improvements on pieces of our transportation system that could be at risk because of climate or other threats.
National parks, how is your department thinking about reducing or mitigating congestion on those roads?
Well, we are funding a number of roadway improvements in and around our national parks, and getting that right can contribute to cleaner air by making sure that there is less congestion, less idling. Many people driving on roads that get busy in Yellowstone, for example, know what it's like when it goes to a crawl. Not that you necessarily want to be speeding through those areas, but you also don't want to be stuck. It's also why we're building charging infrastructure across the country. By the end of this decade, the president's goal is to have about 500,000 chargers across the country. That includes chargers that are going to serve federal lands and national parks.
And then on the subject of national parks, they currently have a backlog on maintenance. Why are we paying for critical infrastructure with competitive grants?
Well, what we've done with the infrastructure package is to increase both the formula dollars that are going out around the country and competitive grants that allow additional supplemental funding. We've got a backlog that has built up over, in my view, about 40 years of underinvestment. We're finally changing that. Thanks to the infrastructure package, that backlog is getting smaller rather than larger. But that doesn't mean that it can be done overnight, and we still have to make tough prioritization decisions about where those dollars are going to go first. My hope is that we can demonstrate enough results out of this five-year infrastructure package that there will be interested in continuing robust funding for the future.
So the federal government is promoting the use of electric vehicles, and you know they're a little bit heavier than those that run on gas. I wonder what that means for the integrity of roads.
Yeah, certainly one thing that we are evaluating is the pressure that heavier vehicles can put on roadways. This is true both with the profile of electric vehicles, although battery technology is still evolving, and the battery is part of what creates that weight, and just the fact that the American consumer has increasingly opted for larger vehicles than you would have seen a couple of decades ago. At the same time, we're investing a lot of research in stronger paving materials, maybe not the most glamorous subject, but one that's going to be very important so that we can get a better value for our taxpayer buck and make sure that our roads are more durable and more sustainable. Many of these more durable road materials are also better able to withstand some of these climate challenges that we're facing, and some of them even have the quality of being able to embody carbon and help being part of the solution to getting carbon out of the atmosphere.
Do you think that coal could eventually be used in those roads?
We've certainly seen some interesting technologies being developed that make use of coal as an input to those materials. We're funding projects at university transportation centers in several locations around the country that I hope will be able to yield promising results. It's early for some of these things to be tested, and it can take a while to see what weather and the passage of time will do to them. But believe it or not, we actually have facilities that do things like run a wheel at pressure over a simulated piece of road thousands or millions of times to accelerate that process so we can get a sense of how these materials hold up.
Wyoming has rejected EV charging infrastructure funds because of the stipulations that there be a charger every 50 miles. But in the state right now, there are some areas that don't have gas stations for every 50 miles. I wonder how you can work with Wyoming to find a solution to that problem.
Yeah, one thing that Governor Gordon has raised is the uniqueness of Wyoming in terms of just how big these stretches of roadway are, and the fact that a solution in a spread out rural state like this is going to be different than other parts of the country. We're conscious that a one-size-fits-all approach is not going to work. It doesn't work for Wyoming or for Alaska or for Manhattan. Every part of the country has its own needs, and we're in good dialogue with the governor and with YDOT about how to make sure that we apply that common sense here in this program.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's State House reporter, David Dudley, speaking with U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg. And big news regarding Teton Pass. After 3 weeks of around-the-clock work, the highway reopened with a temporary detour on Friday. Jackson Hole Community Radio's Dante Fulpola-Ankeny visited the Big Phil landslide site a few days before the roadway was ready for cars to see progress and hear about plans for a more permanent rebuild.
Just days ahead of Highway 22 being cleared for traffic, about half a bus full of state and local legislators, transportation officials, and media members filed into seats in Wilson, donning orange vests and dark sunglasses. Jovial jabber filled the aisles, like a bureaucratic field trip, as passengers were carried up the closed Teton Pass to get a look at the Big Phil landslide for themselves. At the active job site, crews worked to pave a section of the detour behind Wyoming Department of Transportation Director Darren Westby. He congratulated those involved with the detour construction.
That's why we put forward every manpower, brain power, expertise to get this thing open as quick as possible.
The roughly 600-foot detour caps speeds at a reduced 20 miles per hour, and the turn is tighter than before, with a steeper grade of 11%. The usual 60,000-pound weight restriction, think a lightly laden semi-truck, still applies, and trailer traffic will be allowed. Westby says a quick construction was a priority, but also safety, as they say.
Safe is first, right? So we wanted to make sure our design and our construction was always going to be safe.
Scott Evans works with Evans Construction, which won a nearly $500,000 contract for the detour work. He says there has been political and community pressure on YDOT to get the pass open. He and his crews have felt it.
It's like we're torn apart as a family and you want to get that put back together.
His crew members worked 12-hour shifts every day to ensure the pass opened on time.
They aren't getting that decompression time. So, yeah, it's a little bit more taxing on them, and I know they're getting a little burned out.
The quick construction has led some community members and local officials to voice concerns about the safety of the detour and eventual rebuild, despite YDOT's repeated confidence in it. Evans has heard the concerns from some he calls armchair quarterbacks, but he says the project has gone smoothly.
I would stake my reputation on that this fill that we put in would last longer than the fill that just failed.
YDOT has had to dig into its budget to finish the detour. Despite being awarded $6 million in federal quick release emergency funds, more is expected. With the detour ready for action, YDOT now turns its attention to a looming permanent rebuild, expected to begin in August, after the planning, design, and bid process. A completion date is slated for November, before winter storms hit. Initial estimates say the detour and rebuild together will cost about $30 million. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Dante Fopala-Inkney in Jackson.
Coming up, organizers at the first Reproductive Freedom Summit consider the uncertain future of abortion care in the state. That's next on Open Spaces.
Hey there, this is Kelly Trujillo. Join me Saturday mornings for Buffalo Grass, 11 to 1, on listener-supported Wyoming Public Radio. You'll hear the best in bluegrass music, old and new, plus Americana, folk, Western, and even a little bit of Celtic. That's Buffalo Grass, Saturdays at 11 on Wyoming Public Radio.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. The first ever Reproductive Freedom Summit recently took place in Lander. It comes as Wyoming grapples with how to regulate abortion. Lawmakers have enacted a near total ban on surgical and medical abortions, but those bans are blocked while challenges to them ping-pong between the Wyoming Supreme Court and Teton County District Court. For now, it remains legal. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman reports that organizers at the summit considered the uncertain future of abortion care in the state and the ripple effects of that uncertainty.
At a convention center in Lander, roughly 150 people mingle and chat. Some sit at round white tables, while others check out booths from organizations like Wyoming Health Council and Pro-Choice Wyoming. Marcy Shaver is from Goshen County. For her, the issue of abortion access hits close to home because she had
7 pregnancies that had to be terminated. And under the law that they tried to put through post-Roe, my second pregnancy would have killed me.
Shaver says she was glad she could make the decision with her doctor and went on to have a couple kids. Christine Lichtenfels is the executive director of Chelsea's Fund, the Wyoming-based abortion advocacy nonprofit that organized the summit. She wanted to bring people from across the state together to connect and share information with each other since Roe was overturned.
People have seen just how wrong, all the difficulties, the lives that are endangered, the physicians that feel criminalized, other people who are helping who feel like they're going to be criminalized.
She says one theme kept coming up at the summit over and over again in sessions featuring healthcare providers, clergy, lawmakers, and patients.
You know, people do not want governmental interference when it comes to matters of their own body, really, and abortion specifically.
During a panel with state legislators, Democratic Representative Carly Provenza echoes Lichtenfeld's point.
That Constitution says that we have a right to make our own healthcare decisions.
Republican Senator Cale Case represents House District 25, which includes Lander. He co-sponsored the 2012 amendment to the Wyoming Constitution that granted Wyoming citizens the right to make their own healthcare decisions, which, at the time, was in reaction to Obamacare.
Each person having the right to make their own healthcare decisions is very fundamental, very important, and it will prevail.
Mike Yin is the minority floor leader for the State House of Representatives and says access to abortion is a political problem.
We're electing people who don't care about healthcare in the state, they don't care about keeping young people in the state, and they don't care about any of the race families in the state.
A 2022 University of Wyoming survey found only 7% of respondents support a total ban on abortion. A majority favored some limits, like only in cases of rape, incest, or threat to the life of the woman. A little more than a third said abortion is a matter of personal choice. Dr. Jovanina Anthony is an OBGYN in Jackson and is one of the plaintiffs in the ongoing lawsuit against the state's abortion bans. She says those bans present physicians with what she calls an impossible choice.
You're going to risk losing licensure, caring for your family, your career of choice, a prison sentence and a felony charge, or do the right thing for somebody and just hope that it isn't questioned and brings you to court.
Idaho has lost nearly a quarter of its OBGYN since it enacted a near-total ban on abortion, according to a survey from the Idaho Coalition of Safe Healthcare. That loss is starting to happen in Wyoming, too. Dr. Natalie Eggleston grew up in Jackson and was in her last year of residency when Roe was overturned.
I had every intention of coming back to Wyoming. Like I said, just deep roots. Very much planning on this being where my career would flourish and bloom.
But now she's working as an OBGYN in Billings, Montana, where abortion is more clearly codified in the state's constitution. After the summit wraps up, folks chat and mingle over plates of hors d'oeuvres. Attendee Jane Ifland helps escort patients in and out of the Wellspring Health Access Clinic in Casper. It's one of two locations providing abortions in the state, and its opening was delayed for nearly a year when it was torched by an arsonist. She says the summit offered a unique moment.
Someone came up to me that I know quite well. She was crying. And I'm like, what, Joan? And she said, I don't know why I'm crying. And I thought, I know why you're crying. It's a safe space to feel the stress and anxiety that accompanies work she and I do.
From Ifland's perspective, everyone has an abortion story, and they run the whole gamut of emotions, stress, fear, anxiety, and also relief.
No matter what, it's difficult. And the idea that there are people out there who want to make it more difficult in order to exert control is unconscionable.
Sam Dehnert was chief of security at the event. Despite Lander being what he calls a hotbed for pro-life protesting, the day was quiet.
There are reports that there was a demonstration here last night for some reason, but one thing leading to another, we had zero issues with access to this event.
Summit attendees like Lexi Thompson from Laramie see the state laws as a call to action.
I feel like we're at a bit of a turning point in whether or not we're going to move into a super extremist direction or if we're able to like take back some of our rights. So being able to make sure that our voices are heard is the most important thing this next 6 months for me.
As the country heads into election season, it's hard to say where that turning point will lead. And as for the courts, just this Thursday, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that it will allow abortions in medical emergencies in Idaho. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Haberman.
Trumbull County is one of 7 communities in the country to enroll in a federally funded program focused on strengthening economies that rely on coal. Wyoming Public Radio's Jordan Uplinger recently caught up with Campbell County Commissioner Jim Ford to hear about the program and the county's future.
Before we talk about the federal program, can you explain your view on the economic conditions in Campbell County?
You know, I had an old man tell me one time when I was just coming into the workforce, he said, things in Campbell County are either good or they're great. And that was it in his lifetime working in the minerals industry, you know, from the 60s until maybe 10 or 20 years ago, things have always been good or great in Campbell County. By some measures, particularly coal production and coal jobs, we're definitely off the mark from where we have been in the past. Even with all the changes in our mineral industry, the population of the city of Gillette and the town of Wright both continue to increase. So even in the face of the challenges that we have, and there are real challenges, particularly where coal is concerned, things are still good in Campbell County.
So you say times are good in Campbell County, and from a governing perspective, you'd like to keep that going. But there have been similar coal communities around the country that have faced obstacles in continuing to produce that type of energy. So with that in mind, can you explain why Campbell County has enrolled itself in the Building Resilient Economies in Coal Communities initiative?
We'll shorten that and call it the BREC Challenge. You know, this program comes, you know, from funding at the federal level with the U.S. EDA, the Economic Development Administration, administered through NACO, the National Association of Counties, and with a group that they have hired who has expertise in economic planning development and plan execution called Community Builders. What they've done is put together a program that provides high-level professional and pertinent coaching and direction for county leadership at the local government level to try to help engage in the process of, first of all, acknowledging that change is upon us and there's bound to be more change where coal is concerned, and then to do something about it. So what are the goals of the community in terms of what we want to be, say, during the continued challenges to the coal industry and maybe after? And again, this is 5, 10, 20 year type of vision that we need to take into account during this 1 year long BREC challenge. Now, the result of this work with NACO is going to be a plan, but it's a living document, something that we will continually reference and revisit and edit or change based upon the realities of next year and the year after and the year after.
How would you respond to any criticism that says this is just another federal program or federal attempt to push our local or state economy in a direction that the community here does not want?
Yes, there are plenty of people, and myself included to a certain degree, that doesn't want to be unfairly pushed, pulled, or dragged in any particular direction by the federal government. The biggest pressure on the coal industry for the last 15 years has been cheap natural gas. And that has been purely in the realm of the free market. The purposely produced or the byproduct natural gas of oil production is as cheap as it's ever been. That has been the thing that has challenged the coal industry, and particularly the Powder River Basin thermal coal industry, more than any regulation.
Is there a future for Campbell County without the asset of coal leasing the Powder River Basin?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a future. It's going to be different if we have less coal. And it could be markedly different if at some point in the next 20 or so years, there's no coal. That is within the range of possibilities. I don't think it's going to be that way. But 3 years and 5 years and 10 and 20 years down the road, the highly trained workforce, the well-educated workforce, the tremendous capacity we have to build and service and operate mega scale projects, those skills translate into a lot of different industries. If we're mining less coal, it just means that we're probably going to be doing more of something else. And if that involves wind or solar or nuclear, we absolutely have the capacity to support those industries through and beyond this transition.
10 or 20 years down the road, how different could things look? Economically speaking, there's a pretty high rate of self-employed businesses in nearby Sheridan County. Could Campbell County ever transition to or away from energy producer to perhaps manufacturing, goods or services, self-employed businesses?
Short answer, no. I cannot at all, not in my wildest imagination, ever conceive of a time when Campbell County and the state of Wyoming is not the energy breadbasket of the nation. You know, right now we have, you know, probably 10 major businesses. These are mines, power plants, oil and gas companies, oil and gas support companies that have somewhere between 500 and 1,000 employees apiece. It's very likely that a couple of those mines get to be a lot smaller or go away altogether. And I envision those jobs being replaced by not one company with 1,000 jobs, but 50 companies with 20 jobs.
Outside of energy, what else would you like to see revitalized in Campbell County?
You know, for me personally, I want to see growth and growth in population. Yeah, I want to challenge you a little bit just on the terminology, revitalization. There are lots of federal subsidy type programs or assistance programs that are focused on people and places and industries that have, let's say, hit bottom and want to bounce back. We don't need to revitalize, Jordan. We're still vital. We're still the economic engine of this state. Okay. We just want to keep growing and we want to prevent the decline, okay, from loss of tax revenues and the potential risk of not being able to provide the services and the quality of life investments that we've all become accustomed to here. And so for us here in Campbell County and through this BREC challenge, I'll admit that we are probably a little unique in terms of the other communities across the nation. We don't have to rebuild. We need to prevent the decline, okay? We need to continue on this upward growth trajectory that we've had here for the last 45 years, and that's our intention, absolutely.
That was Campbell County Commissioner Jim Ford speaking with Wyoming Public Radio's Jordan Uplinger about the county's participation in the Building Resilient Economies in Coal Communities initiative. The Road to Cheyenne. That's our series looking at the primary elections this year, and it's coming up next. Stick with us on Open Spaces.
If you missed season 8 of The Modern West,
Grandma, what do we do if we see a wolf?
Now's your chance to binge all 6 episodes.
I really do believe courage is like a muscle.
High altitude tales.
Yesterday we rode 78 miles.
Which is our longest day.
It's our longest day and almost 4,000 feet of elevation climb.
Find the whole season at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Horse hugs are the best hugs in the world.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Nikki Willett. And now, The Road to Cheyenne, our special series previewing the primary elections. For the next 4 editions of The Road to Cheyenne, we'll be focusing on a region of the state, and we'll dive deeper into some of the money dynamics in these races. To help me understand all of this, Wyoming Public Media's Northwest reporter Olivia Wheats and state government reporter Chris Clements are both joining me today. Thank you both for being here.
Good to be here.
Thanks for having us, Nikki.
Aces. So for the purposes of this show, when we say the Northwest, we're thinking Cody, Powell, all the way down to Thermopolis and the Bighorn Mountains making the natural eastern boundary of the state. So Olivia, you've been talking to people in this area. How are they feeling about this election season?
Yeah, I talked to voters at a popular coffee shop in downtown Cody and the Recreation Center, and I asked them, are there any particular races or candidates they're following and what issues are most important to people?
What stood out?
Housing and property taxes were a big one. I caught Ernest Gordon at the coffee shop. He's a therapist here in Cody.
My dad grew up here. I moved here after I got out of the Marine Corps.
Gordon talked about what development looks like in an older town like Cody.
When you go to Jackson, everything's in uniform. It looks beautiful. It's so amazing. When you come here, it feels a little disorganized. You got a building like this over here, a building like that over there, and I think it'd be nice if there's a little bit more organization.
And he's also concerned about housing.
If I buy a $400,000 house in Cody, Wyoming, with interest rates and a VA loan serving my country, I'm paying $2,800 a month to live in that house. That's insane. I don't know what anyone can do about that, but I can't buy a house right now.
I also talked to Amy Skates outside of the rec center. She's an insurance agent, and she's worried about property taxes.
With the rising cost of everything, that's a concern to a lot of people.
Interesting. So what else did you hear talking to voters in Cody?
One wanted increased school choice.
Like charter schools?
And a few people mentioned national issues. One didn't want Wyoming to become a sanctuary state for immigrants.
We're lucky to be here in Wyoming compared to all the other places.
Another person talked about wanting to continue to send support to countries and peoples that the U.S. has already pledged commitments to.
That we don't just, you know, walk away because things get tough.
Olivia, you also mentioned that you asked folks if they're following particular candidates. Did anyone drop any names?
Yeah, when I talked to Jim Ulmer, he's a retired geologist. He said he supports Representative Harriet Hageman because she wants to take grizzlies off the threatened species list.
I just know from living here my whole life, there's way too many.
Ulmer also mentioned Matt Hall, Cody's mayor, who's running for a House seat. He said he's known him for years, and he's a Cody person.
Okay, so for sure, not a scientific poll here, but taking the temp of voters around Cody. Thanks, Olivia. Let's take a quick step back. Chris, remind us, how many Senate and House seats are up for grabs in this primary?
So all House seats in the state are on the ballot, as are 15 Senate seats. And a big theme this year is how many Republicans are facing primary challenges from their own party.
Right. This is a split between the more moderate conservatives in the Wyoming caucus versus the more far-right conservatives in the Freedom Caucus.
Exactly. So the Freedom Caucus got a loose start in 2017, and by 2020, they claimed membership of nearly a third of the state house. And last election, in 2022, they counted roughly 26 members.
That's like almost half of the House's total 62 seats.
Yeah, it's been enough for them to veto bills on introduction. So we're watching races that could reshape power in Cheyenne between the Wyoming and Freedom caucuses.
All right, so let's dig into some of those races. Olivia, what's on your radar?
One of the races I'm following is House Seat 24 in Park County, which includes part of Cody and the scenic area near Yellowstone National Park. Sandy Newsom, a moderate Republican, has had this seat since 2019, but she's not running again.
Ooh, so who's seeking her spot?
Newsom is endorsing Matt Hall. He's a two-term mayor of Cody, who voter Jim Ulmer mentioned earlier. Hall's worked in real estate and insurance and for his family's business. Hall says he has maintained a fiscally conservative budget, even with Cody's growth, and worked on finding affordable housing solutions at the local level. And these are two things that he'd like to continue focusing on in the state house.
Who's his primary opponent?
Hall is running against Nina Weber. It's Weber's third attempt to win this seat. She is the current national committeewoman for the Wyoming Republican Party, and she's worked in the oil and gas and healthcare industries, and she also served as a county clerk in Hot Springs County. Weber wants to reduce government spending, stop Medicaid expansion, and vote against what she calls radical school curriculum. According to her website, she's endorsed by anti-abortion and Second Amendment groups. Just to note, last year, Weber was accused of reckless shooting in an elk hunting incident. The charges were dropped. Weber said she was the, quote, victim of a political hit job by virtue of being the Republican National Committee woman for Wyoming, end quote.
You know, this race is interesting because it's kind of a blank slate.
Yeah, it's looking like Hall would try to continue what Newsom had done, and Weber would shake things up, but it still remains to be seen. In a local newspaper article, Weber said that the Freedom Caucus follows the Republican Party platform and that she agrees with their focus on Second Amendment rights and low taxes, among other issues. She's also said that she's open to working with both the Freedom Caucus and the Wyoming Caucus. Meanwhile, Hall's website says he will avoid the dysfunctional fights and performance artistry in the state legislature and that he will focus on cooperation. the Wyoming caucus backed him in a Facebook post back in March.
Olivia, another race in your area that I'm eager to hear more about is House District 50. That's the eastern portion of Cody, Clark, Ralston, Heart Mountain, and Sunlight Crandall.
Rachel Rodriguez-Williams is seeking a third term, and this is the first time that she'll face a primary challenger. Rodriguez-Williams, she's a very visible member of the Freedom Caucus. She was the primary sponsor of the so-called Life is a Human Right Act and the trigger law that banned abortion after the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade.
Who's trying to take her on?
David Hill. He's an attorney based in Cody. His campaign website highlights his frustration with party infighting. He wants those abortion bans to go into effect, and he also wants to expand access to mental health care, limit access to social media for minors, rein in property taxes, and he lists a slew of what he groups as personal freedoms. He opposes red flag gun laws and wait periods, opposes vaccine requirements, and supports securing national borders. He wants to see lawmakers bring their unique perspectives and values to the Capitol and not vote in lockstep as part of factions.
Interesting. Let's turn now to the Senate. Of course, the Freedom Caucus is only an entity in the House, but many senators do align with Freedom Caucus priorities, and they work in tandem at times. So tell me about the race for Senate District 18, that's Park County. And this is where a more far-right Republican is trying to defend his seat against a more moderate Republican.
Right. So Tim French has held that seat since 2021. And yeah, he aligns with the Freedom Caucus. He's co-sponsored bills that ban gender transitioning for minors and bar transgender girls from participating in girls' sports. He's pushed for a smaller state budget, lower property taxes, boosting school choice, and Second Amendment rights. French won his last primary in 2020 pretty handily over three others. This year, he's facing a challenge from Landon Greer. Greer has been on the Cody City Council for the past 8 years. He owns Asphalt Quality Paving, a company his father started. In interviews with local papers and on his campaign website, he says his main goal is to preserve Wyoming's legacy for his children. He has 8 and future grandchildren.
And did he say why he's running now?
Yeah, so he said he's been thinking about running for years, and it just felt like it was the right time. He wants to be a conservative voice and promote civility. He also backs lowering property taxes, and he supports reducing regulations and fostering a business environment that keeps young people in the state.
Okay, so another example of party infighting there. And, you know, as we talk about different caucuses in the state, Chris, you've been digging into the finance for their PACs, these are political action committees, and you recently reported that the biggest donor to the Wyoming caucus last year was from Cody.
Yeah, that's right. That was Jessica Case. She's a school board trustee in Cody who donated $20,000 to the PAC. Case told me she's been frustrated with the direction that politics are going in Wyoming.
I was concerned about people advocating for national agendas instead of local issues.
Case also told me she's most excited about local candidates running for office, like Cody Mayor Matt Hall.
And my understanding is that the Freedom Caucus PAC had 2 top donors.
Right, so I'll start out by saying neither of those donors responded to requests for comment on their motivations for giving. One donor was Dan Brophy, a former commodities trader who lives in Wilson. He and his wife, Carlene, they successfully sued the Secretary of State in 2014 to kill a limit on political contributions in Wyoming. And Brophy also wrote an op-ed in Cowboy State Daily in 2021 that chastised Wyoming's federal reps for not coming out against the results of the 2020 presidential election. He claimed that the election was riddled with voter fraud, though there's no evidence to support that, and numerous state and federal courts have disagreed with that conclusion. The other donor actually was a trust operating on behalf of businessman Jay Kemmer. Kemmer is interesting to me because he hosted a fundraiser for the National House Freedom Caucus in Jackson in 2021, and that generated a lot of controversy. He also recently sold Jackson Hole Mountain Resort.
Interesting. So 2 big donors there from Teton County. I want to dig into something our guest on the last Road to Cheyenne segment said. This is Andrew Garner. He's a political science professor at UW, and he talked about 2 different styles of campaigning. He called it retail politics and air wars. Retail being kind of man on the street, volunteers knocking on doors, word of mouth, while air wars is more spendy. TV, radio advertisements, billboards, all that kind of thing. And Garner said that retail politics is more effective in Wyoming.
Right. Andrew told me recently that it comes down to so-called air wars being impersonal and somewhat ineffective in Wyoming, and in the U.S. more broadly. He pointed to field studies that political scientists across the country have done since the 2010s to see which campaign strategy was more effective. He said these studies tend to show two tactics work best.
One is providing information to voters, not necessarily about policy or about the candidates, but about where to vote, how to vote, when to vote, sort of the things they need to more effectively turn out and vote. The other is more of a personal touch.
Think knocking on doors, leaving handwritten notes. Part of the problem is that TV and radio ads cost a lot, and more rural races in our state tend to be operating on a pretty small budget. That said, there's a lot of nuance around choices like this.
Think about a rural area where you have a huge geographic space and a few people spread out. Well, now think about how much it costs in gas to contact every one of those voters. It may not now be cost effective.
Keep in mind, though, that many campaigns in Wyoming specifically don't feel the need to operate using either strategy because of how safe their seats are in general.
How intriguing. Well, that's a wrap for this edition of The Road to Cheyenne. Thanks for being with me here today, Chris and Olivia.
Yeah, thanks for having us again.
If you have a question about voting, electoral process, specific races, or candidates, please feel free to give us a call and leave us a voicemail at 307-766-4314. We may use your voicemail on the show. Or go to wyomingpublicmedia.org, scroll down to our America Amplified banner, and fill out a form to ask your question. The Road to Cheyenne will be back for the next Open Spaces on July 12th. We will be looking at the northeast part of the state. You can also find this series online at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Up next, we get a tour of the new arbor at the Eastern Shoshone Powwow. This is Open Spaces.
If you're searching for a break from the news, look no further than Wyoming Public Media. We provide three music channels for whatever may be your taste or mood: Classical Wyoming, Jazz Wyoming, and Wyoming Sounds. You can find them all on a variety of platforms for listening, including streaming, Wyoming Public Radio app, smart speakers, and FM radio. Just go to wyomingpublicmedia.org and listen.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. The Eastern Shoshone tribe debuted a new arbor at their annual powwow in Fort Washakie this summer. The wooden structure offers shade for spectators and encircles dancers and singers. And it also offers a lot more room. Room to grow is how many attendees see it. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman asked folks what they think of the new addition.
It's a sweltering afternoon on the Wind River Reservation. But the nearly triple-digit heat hasn't stopped the crowds from coming out to the 64th annual Eastern Shoshone Powwow.
You're going to have a singer of your drum group sing a song that's other than a powwow song.
The event's MCs are pulling together an impromptu sing-off. They're building up the hype for the upcoming grand entry, which kicks off the more traditional dancing and singing. And the singers show up.
All you know is when I'm with you, I'll make you free and swim through your veins like a fish in the sea. I'm singing, I'm a Barbie girl in a Barbie world. Fantastic, trapped in plastic, ready for the fall. Won't you do this all the time?
After the contest, the grand entry gets underway.
So please rise and remove your head covers as we go to Spring Creek, our host drum, for that grand entry song, please.
The Eagle Staff Carriers and Color Guard enters, followed by Powwow Royalty. As the music passes from drum group to drum group, a long line of dancers in traditional regalia make their way into the arena. They're young, old, and every age in between, wearing brightly colored clothes adorned with ribbons, intricate beadwork, feathers, and jingles. All of this unfolds on a fresh canvas, the new arbor. 86 wooden poles were installed by hand in two concentric circles. each painted teal with yellow, orange, red, and black blocks of color on the top and bottom. Roofing on the top creates shade for spectators. It's twice as tall as the old arbor with four sections of raised stands.
We needed a new arbor. The last one it was too small for what Eastern Shoshone Indian Days is today.
That's Susanna Tillman, the chairwoman of the Eastern Shoshone Entertainment Committee. The event draws thousands of spectators, registered dancers, and food and craft vendors. Tillman says this arbor was a priority for the tribe. They used unrestricted American Rescue Plan Act funds from COVID. It took just about a year for it to be built in time to debut at this year's event. But there's still a few final touches to add.
So there still needed to be artwork. That's the main part, is the artwork on the back of the four grandstands. And then it has so much potential for, it has room to grow. So we can continue adding more grandstands, more vendor space, more handicap parking.
Clellan Tillman is also on the entertainment committee.
So the big thing that we didn't have is we used to always go rent like light towers and things like that. So that, you know, takes a cost out of that, where we actually have lighting built inside, outside the arena, underneath the seating areas.
Amani Ironcloud agrees. She's a 16-year-old dancer from nearby Ethity.
I like the new lights and the new seating. I like there's more room definitely for more visitors. And you can see like we don't have to use those big old huge lights no more. It's just awesome. I love it at night.
Ironcloud is wearing a long teal dress with geometric flowers and purple jingles. She's making it work with the heat.
It was kind of hard yesterday, but I got kind of used to it. It's not that hard today.
Sylvana Coversup is also dancing. She's from the Crow Reservation and is competing in fancy shawl dancing.
It's very different from anything else I've ever seen back home, and I hope to visit the powwow more.
Her dad, Buzzy, says he's liking the crafting on the new arbor, and he's got a personal connection to the folks who set it up.
One of them was actually one of my adopted brothers who helped put this together. So, you know, for him to be able to be motivated like that, to bring children up and just to give them something to look back on as he gets older, I helped put that together, you know?
Alan Enos is Eastern Shoshone and from Fort Washakie. He says there's just a couple more arbor odds and ends that need to come together.
They're going to have to do a little repairs on the lawn and stuff. They say the lawn's pretty bumpy, but I think as long as they keep putting water on there, they'll probably go in there with a big roller and roll that baby where it's flat. I think they'll be all right.
Enos is with two older friends, Lyle Oldman and Waylon Benassi. They've all been coming to the powwow for years.
Since we're kids.
Yeah.
These guys, since they're kids, long before. These guys are older than me. These guys are old guys.
And with the new arbor up and running, that's the hope, that there will be many more powwows for generations to come. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Haberman. As Laramie's Pride Fest celebrations built to a crescendo, the community gathered downtown for a drag show at the Collective. The performers leaned into the theme of the night, all things floral and blossoming, but they each brought a unique perspective to that theme, and to drag itself, demonstrating queer joy even as new legislation targets LGBTQ+ rights. Wyoming Public Radio's Jeff Victor caught up with the kings and queens backstage ahead of their big night.
In a packed venue, under rainbow-colored lights and a misty, fabricated fog, Daisy Mays works a crowd of more than 100. She's wearing a short black dress, knee-high cowboy boots, and a black hat to match, as well as a full face of makeup.
You guys ready to keep this show going?
The crowd is already amped, charged up in the wake of four electrifying dance numbers. And Daisy Mays treats the audience to a song, a cover of Anais Mitchell's Flowers from the musical Hadestown.
What I wanted was to fall asleep, to close my eyes and disappear like a petal on a stream, a feather on.
The show tune is on the somber side, and it affords a moment to reflect on why the show is necessary and what it means to the community, both philosophically and politically. Backstage, Vagina Kortz says drag is first and foremost about having fun.
If you can't look like you're having fun, then the audience isn't going to have fun. If the audience isn't having fun, then they're not having fun. Girl, why are they here?
But while Daisy Mays, Vagina Quartz, and the others ensure the crowd has a blast, they're also doing important work in the eyes of the queer community. For one, drag shows subvert expectations, and they do so to applause. On stage, Vagina wears both her real beard and a flowing dress. That visual can be liberatory for members of the crowd, some with beards, others in dresses, who might be drawn to both, but feel restricted to one.
Don't hold yourself back, just be yourself, and you're gonna get farther if you're just more genuine.
But drag is also about demonstrating resilience in the face of oppression. That's something Vagina's fellow performer, Carnivora Flora, understands intimately. Carnivora grew up in a small religious Wyoming town. Openly gay and less openly trans, there was plenty about their hometown that made them feel unwelcome.
It was very strange to grow up in a place that's, you know, beautiful and amazing and I love, but then feel like I wasn't made to be there.
But Carnivora came to Laramie over a decade ago, and as so many young queer Wyoming people do, found an inclusive community and a place to experiment artistically. They started doing drag with Laramie Burlesque around 2014, before co-launching the Laramie Dragonettes with a friend.
We focused really hard on trying to create a queer and trans safe space in Wyoming, and it was really nice. I really loved it, and then COVID happened.
And all of a sudden, the drag community had only limited access to their favored form of expression.
I think I did a single drag look and took photos, and then the rest of quarantine went into depression.
The world has since reopened, and drag has seen a resurgence, but it's come back amid an altered political landscape. Drag performers, despite their long history in American culture, have been painted as predators seeking to corrupt the youth. These accusations are leveled not just at drag queens, but at the entire LGBTQ plus community. And those accusations have underpinned new legislation, blocking access to healthcare and requiring schools to out queer children to their parents. Carnivora says growing up in Wyoming gave them a lot of resilience, and it's useful at times like these.
Moments like this, when it seems to get like the hardest, is the moments when we need to have events like this.
One might think drag shows are simply a way for the queer community to blow off steam. And for many, it probably is. But these shows can also be something more. And that's where Carnivora Flora's work comes in. Work that is more conceptual.
Because my character isn't really a woman or a man. Carnivora isn't even supposed to be a human.
Carnivora is a prehistoric plant goddess, a figure of judgment and protection and queer power. And that fits this year's theme perfectly, blossoming out west. Organizers were inspired by the prickly pear cactus, a plant native to the west that is equal parts beautiful and hardy. And, like Carnivora's primordial stage persona, it's always been here.
Like the queerness of people in Wyoming, like the trans strength of people in Wyoming, it has always been here, and just because it's not as loud doesn't mean that it hasn't been there this whole time.
And it's perhaps never louder, never more on display than when Rocky Mountain drag queens and kings take to the stage and bring down the house.
And you guys have a wonderful rest of your ride month, okay?
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Jeff Victor.
Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Thanks to Melody Edwards, today's audio producer, Ivy Engel, our digital and social media producer, and thank you to Cody Hume, our social media manager. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.